Rocks seem almost like the dictionary example of boring. But in 1788, some curious guy standing on a rugged Scottish shoreline saw something entirely different than a boring pile of rocks. It was a revelation that shattered time itself and made them physically dizzy with wonder. In this episode, we follow those guys to one of science's greatest discoveries, and we investigate what it has to tell us about the nature of wonder itself. It's I Heart Rocks, my friends. I'm Ben Lord. Let's talk about what we love. Every semester of the 9th grade Earth Science Geology unit, I would take my classes on a field trip. We'd walk to the parking lot at the west end of campus and look at a rock. Yep, that's it. That was the whole field trip. This wasn't some fancy formation with glacial potholes or colorful minerals or garnet crystals or anything. These rocks were pretty much the same ones in the road cut that everyone drove by on their way to school. They were brown and gray, kind of flaky. You got 5 minutes, I'd tell the students, to write down as much as you can about what you notice and what you wonder. They'd look at me, then they'd exchange silent glances with each other, and some would jot down literally a word or two on their clipboard. But after about 45 seconds, almost everyone had run out of things to say. Now, a week before, these same kids had been exuberantly curious about space and climate and oceans, and now they were stifling yawns. Almost every semester, some kid would grumble under their breath, "Oh God, not rocks again. I hated doing rocks in middle school." Let's face it, rocks are not sexy. They're not alive, they don't do tricks, or make weird noises, or explode. Most of them aren't even colorful. There is nothing less interesting or more common than a rock. That field trip was always less of a lesson on geology, and more of a lesson on the human mind. And for the next part of that lesson, we're going to have to go on another field trip, a bit farther than the parking lot. We're going to have to go to the southeast shore of Scotland in the spring of 1788. Our instructor on this field trip will be one John Playfair. John was a Presbyterian minister who got distracted from his ecclesiastical calling by the intellectual excitement of the movement we now call the Enlightenment. The city of Edinburgh was a major hub of this new thinking. It was home to people like David Hume, the philosopher, Adam Smith, the economist guy who wrote The Wealth of Nations, and James Watt, after whom the unit of power is named, and a whole bunch of other famous dead smart guys. They regularly gathered to talk about heady new ideas about liberty and progress and reason and science. Now John, our protagonist here, was a smart, friendly, and charming guy. And because he was so smart and friendly and charming, the philosophers and thinkers and scientists of Edinburgh, they welcomed him. He was a founding member of the Royal Society of Edinburgh, which was kind of a swanky and exclusive science club. And a few years later, he got a job as professor of mathematics at the university. John was 40 years old when he set out with some friends on a voyage along the Scottish coast. I have no idea of his opinion on rocks, but I do know that he greatly admired his traveling companion, a 62-year-old gentleman farmer named James Hutton. The cruise along the Scottish coast was Hutton's idea. And I do know that Hutton, without a doubt, was a guy who found rocks very interesting. Hutton had spent decades poking around in any ditch, hole, or riverbed he could, and in doing so, he developed a theory that he was determined to put to the test. So yeah, you guessed it. They were going out looking for rocks. On one day in June, they landed at an outcrop that stuck out into the sea not far from the English border, a place called Sycar Point. Look at pictures of it and you'll see that the place is kind of a rugged beauty, but that the rocks that make it up don't immediately strike one as being anything special. I mean, they're reddish-brown, they're hard, you know, they're rocks. I can imagine my students yawning already, but James Hutton was not yawning. The thing about Sycar Point is that upon closer inspection, you begin to see two sets of layers. On the top are some layers arranged horizontally, nothing particularly surprising. But beneath them are vertical layers of rock. How did the rock get that way? The question doesn't occur to most of us when we go to Sicker Point. We're out looking at the ocean, or checking out the cute graduate student, or mentally preparing a shopping list. If any one of Playfair's colleagues did inquire about the origins of the rock, the relatively straightforward answer at the time was Noah's flood. Most of the rocks on Earth's surface, so the thinking went, had crystallized from dissolved minerals in the floodwaters. If you've ever tried to grow crystals in a jar or make rock candy, you'll be familiar with the idea. And by one Irish bishop's oft-cited biblical calculation, that flood would have occurred in the year 2348 BC, about as old as the Great Pyramids in Egypt, or exactly 4,136 years before James Hutton and John Playfair set foot on Sicker Point on that June day. Since the waters of that cataclysmic flood had drained away, the earth had remained relatively unchanged. The mountains were immovable, the rivers stuck to their courses. But this explanation didn't satisfy James Hutton. As a farmer, he was eminently aware that the land was always changing. His farm fields were always losing soil to the rain. He could see it washing away into those drainage ditches, ditches he was always having to dredge. But if the soils in his fields kept washing away, as they undeniably did, then why didn't they run out of dirt? Why hadn't they already run out of dirt? Now that was a question that hardly anyone else had even bothered to ask. But Hutton had chased it for years. He followed where the soil washed out of his fields would go. The ditch emptied into a stream, the stream into a river, the river into the ocean. And that little bit of soil that was carried along with it would finally settle on the ocean floor. Many of the rocks in Scotland looked just as if the sand or mud of the ocean bottom had solidified somehow. Could it be that once, long ago, they had been under the sea? You know, if they were, then that might explain why his fields had not entirely washed away. If rocks from below were being lifted up and being crumbled back into bits of sand and mud, well, then that might replenish the soils of his fields. In Hutton's mind, God, in his wisdom, had designed an earth to constantly provide what people needed. It was a beautiful idea, but the real test was whether it could explain real features of real landscapes and real rocks. Rocks like the kind that you find at Sicker Point. And this was why Hutton had invited his friends on this exploration. Now at the point, Hutton was thinking aloud. He was practically electric with what he saw, and as he worked it out in front of his friends, they began to feel the electricity too. If Hutton was right, then all of these layers of rock had formed on the bottom of an ocean, built from the pieces washed off of some ancient land, which would then crystallize and solidify into layers of stone. The layers in the bottom would be the oldest, of course, because new layers could only form on top of the old. I mean, they couldn't be formed under them. But why were those bottom layers vertical? Well, if they had been pushed up by some underground force, the slow warping and buckling of the land could have tilted them. By then, they would have been above sea level again. They would have been a different land, which would slowly crumble them again, and their bits would wash out to the sea. But what then of the horizontal layers on top? Well, that would be easy to explain if this land had eroded all the way down to below the level of the ocean again. Then the eroded tops of the vertical layers would now become a new sea bottom, and they would get covered over with new layers of mud and sand washed off of some other land nearby, which would harden into new layers of stone. I can almost imagine Hutton looking up from the rocks at this point to take in the whole landscape, the sea, the cliffs, the sky, and realize that it was still going on. Right in that moment, the layers under his feet were slowly, inevitably washing back into the ocean, making what would someday become new land again. This was one of the first times in history that anyone had ever described what we now call the rock cycle, an idea that strikes ennui in the hearts of ninth graders the world over. And if their learning about it was anything like the dry and lifeless rendering of it that I got when I was in middle school, you can hardly blame them. But it was not so for John Playfair. The vision of absolutely staggering lengths of time made him physically dizzy. This wasn't just an idea. You could see it happening. Recalling this moment many years later, John Playfair wrote, "The mind seems to grow giddy by looking so far into the abyss of time." And while we listened with earnestness and admiration to the philosopher who was now unfolding to us the order and series of these wonderful events, we became sensible how much farther reason may sometimes go than imagination can venture to follow. I first stumbled on Playfair's account of that day in an old textbook, and I immediately fell in love with it. Even in his long-winded late 18th century sentences, you can tell that he is breathless, that he was at a loss for words. He was watching the idea of the rock cycle, one of the most powerful ideas in all of science, being born right in front of him. His whole world was being remade literally and figuratively all at once. We think of the imagination as boundless. But in that moment, John Playfair had come up against its limits. We become sensible how much farther reason may sometimes go than imagination can venture to follow. We can figure out even that which we cannot imagine. I like to imagine John Playfair picking up a stone there and seeing it as if for the first time. It looked solid, but how many times had the bits of it been made and unmade, broken and reassembled? And then I imagine him realizing the implications, how long it would take for rain and wind to break the rock in his hand into bits. A few thousand years? Maybe as long as all the history that he thought there was. But at Sichar Point, he could see that something like that had happened over and over and over. All the history that he thought there was just the last moment of time. Suddenly, those boring rocks were more than just things to walk and trip on. They were the story of time itself on a world that was roiling with change, just at a scale too grand for people to see. Every rock tells a story, and their stories are long. When you look at one, you are peering into the great abyss of time that left Playfair feeling giddy. We are mayflies. To the rocks, we are as insubstantial as the mist that burns off in a sunrise. In the 21st century, we're so used to hearing about this, about how vast space and time are. We're so used to hearing about billions and trillions that I suspect that we have lost some of the giddiness of the realization that the Earth is billions of years old. I mean, who can really absorb those numbers anyway? If any number ends in illions, that just basically means it's too much to think about. And if my students fail to see this when I take them to a rock outcrop by the West parking lot, that's not a failure of their character. How many generations of people lived good lives without thinking about rocks at all? Except maybe something to build a house with. And really, if we were open like that to all the wonders around us all the time, we would do nothing but stand amazed. But every once in a while, it is wonderful to be amazed. And I like to give my students amazement when I can. So sometimes I tell them the story of Hutton and Playfair out at that rock outcrop in the parking lot. And I hope that it helps them to remember two things the way it has helped me. The first is that boring is not a property of rocks. It is not a property of any object or subject. Boring is something that we bring. Meaningfulness isn't something we find. It's something we fill the world with our attention. We have the capacity to find wonder everywhere, even in something like a rock. Indeed, a rock can be so profoundly wonderful that we find ourselves giddy at the edge of a great abyss. The second thing is that we don't just have the capacity to find wonder in something like a rock, but that we have the ability to pay that wonder forward. When we stop worrying about whether what we love is cool or useful or productive, and we just love it demonstratively and expressively, we can reveal its wonder to others. Through our own love, we can make the familiar strange for someone else again, just as Hutton did for Playfair, and just as Playfair did for me, even with something as familiar as a rock. Sometimes a rock is just a rock, and sometimes it's a keyhole to deep time. I Heart This strives in every episode to make the familiar strange again, to pay the wonder forward. So can you. Think of someone who would appreciate this story or your favorite I Heart This episode and send them a link or leave a review wherever you're listening. And thanks. I Heart This is written, edited, and produced by me, Ben Lord. Our logo is designed by Brian Imaro Cribbs. Our website is iheartthispodcast.com. And you can email me at ben@iheartthispodcast.com. Thank you so much for listening. And be kind, be curious, and be thankful.